were in a day when Sputniks and explorers dashed through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere. No nation can win a war. Today we no longer have a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Just hello, whenever or wherever you are listening. I'm Michael Change. I'm going to be your host today on this, the first edition of We Are Change UK podcast. This podcast is released on the 11th of September, 2008, 7 years after the momentous attacks of 9/11. Now, 7 years is a long time, and a very long time to be silent. It's been 7 years of war, 7 years of occupation, 7 years of watching our civil liberties disappear one by one. 7 long years, mainly based on a pack of transparent lies about what happened on 9/11/2001. So we wanted to put this out today as a salute, really. This is going out to all you brave and tireless activists who are out there today in your own countries, in your own cities, calling like we are in We Are Change UK, calling despite the hassle, despite the ridicule, despite the difficulties, calling for 9/11 truth. We thank you. You inspire us and embolden us to act ourselves in unity to bring about the change we're all desperate for. We hope wherever you are, you're making yourself visible today, and not just today, but on the 11th of every month. Many of you will already know that there is a global campaign of solidarity called Truth Action. This is going on in North America, in Europe, in Australia, and even Southeast Asia. It's growing, and this year we need you to get active and become a part of this thing. Together we can crack this, but it's going to be done by every last human being who can see through the lies, getting away from their keyboards, and getting out there on the streets. Find out about actions in your own area or set up your own by visiting www.truthaction.org. That's all the W's, truthaction, one word, .org. Well, let's play a tune, shall we? Because the thing is, we 9/11 activists can be a maudlin lot. We're living with 9/11 every day. We campaign to get the victims' family members' questions answered. We work to support the first responders' rights and health. We speak out against illegal war, illegal occupation, illegal torture, and the use of illegal and immoral weapons like white phosphorus and depleted uranium. Just stick a pin. Let's just talk about DU for a second. Depleted uranium. Depleted uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. That is a long time. If anyone ever tells you to move on, tell them you'll wait 4.5 billion years first. And then think about getting on with watching TV and buying new shoes. This stuff will probably still be causing horrific birth defects, heightened rates of cancer and leukemia, and all manner of diseases for longer than the human race dwells on this planet. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is good reason to take this struggle very seriously. Many, many reasons to take this very seriously. But sometimes that isn't the best thing for campaigning. So sometimes good when someone comes out with something positive and lighthearted and puts that into the mix, you know, bringing truth to the people, that can put a smile on their faces and a few thoughts in their minds. Now, on that note, let's have the freebies and their YouTube hit, 9/11's a Lie. It reminds me of something, but I can't think what.
This is from the old school, new school.
Hello?
Hello?
Is that the terrorist hotline?
It is, yes.
Basically, I'm phoning because I found out some information about the 7/7 bombings that concerned me, and I was hoping that I could talk to someone about that.
Okay, go on then.
I don't know if you're aware, do you know who Peter Power is?
I'm aware of the name, yeah.
Okay, and so are you aware that he was carrying out a training exercise that envisaged the exact same circumstances that occurred at the same stations and at the exact same time?
Right, what's the information you want to pass to us?
No, I'm concerned about that because it's obviously, it would suggest something a little bit more sinister than what we believe to be true, what the government has told us and what the papers have told us.
Okay. And how have you found out that information then? You've found it on the internet or...?
Well, he went on television. He went on, I think, ITN and BBC Radio and said exactly what I told you.
Okay, okay. All right then, well, we'll look into it.
Is that anything more than that?
What's that, sorry?
Well, you're familiar with the name. Have people phoned up before and mentioned that? Mentioned Mr. Power?
His name has been mentioned, yeah, but ultimately we'll have a look at it and we'll see what we can come up with. I doubt very much that it's credible information, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's his own information.
Yeah, indeed. But I doubt that there's a conspiracy, because obviously there's a trial going on at the moment and there's various bits and bobs.
What do you mean you doubt there's a conspiracy?
Well, you mentioned the word conspiracy, didn't you? You mentioned the word that there was maybe, you know, more behind it than meet the eye. Is that not what you implied?
Yeah, I didn't use the term conspiracy, but I would have to say to you that two or more people conspiring to commit a crime is a conspiracy anyway. So regardless of whether it's a Muslim conspiracy or a state-sponsored conspiracy, it's a conspiracy nonetheless.
Right, indeed. Okay. Yeah. Well, ultimately, like I say, there's a trial ongoing at a court at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, but then so Peter Power's not in the dock, is he?
Okay. Leave it with us, mate, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
You were just listening to Gareth from We Are Change UK, and he's been ringing the terrorism hotline here and asking what the point of what they do is when you consider that the war on terror is a sham built on a foundation of lies. We'll be playing a few more segments of this correspondence throughout the podcast, and if you want to listen to it all, we've included them in the extras, which you can find on our website, wearechange.org.uk. Coming up next is a timeless piece about New York hip-hop artist Immortal Technique. It's a little mixdown of a Q&A session which he gave for students in London recently. The whole recording is too long for the podcast, unfortunately, so we've put it in the extra section as well. But we hope you enjoy this little sampling of his wisdom and passion. If you want to catch the man himself doing what he does best, and you're lucky enough to be in or around London, check out his show at the Coronet Theatre in Elephant Castle on September the 20th. You can buy tickets on ticketweb.co.uk or pay £25 on the door. And most of us when we are at Change UK will be around there, if not in the gig, certainly outside it. So we hope to see you there.
Love inspires me, you know? I think at the risk of sounding ridiculous, as Che Guevara once said, that the revolutionary is motivated by feelings of love. We're good people and we want to see a decent change in this world. We want to create a mental revolution so that people can facilitate an economic and a political one. And I'm sure there are forces that are trying to stop me, and that's just the nature of the world, the yin and the yang. You know, I'm pushing one way, someone's going to push another way.
A revolution is a constant communication, a constant change, a constant updating of our ideals, a constant challenging. Oppression, unfortunately, continues all over the world, whether it's political repression, whether it's economic repression, whether it's political terrorism, whether it's religious terrorism, whether it's state-sponsored economic terrorism. We have to understand there are many dimensions to the demons that we face. At some point, we all come to a turning point in our lives where we see the things that we're involved with and we wonder if they really are worth the time that we invest in them. when it came time to self-reflection, it was a personal decision of mine to come to terms with what ability I had as an artist to change that, or at least to bring that to the forefront of a political discussion for people. Since day one, it was never enough to rhyme for me. Some of the most recent projects I was involved in was some work with the South Central Farm, which was a collective of farmers that came from Mexico and from indigenous communities up and were granted a piece of land, right? And this opened my eyes to land right issues that are going on all around the world. It's in Africa or Central America or the Caribbean, and it gave me a clear understanding of an immigration crisis as well, because people were talking for their immigration status in America. So besides the South Central Farm, I was also involved with working with a group called SJP in the United States, which is Students for Justice in Palestine. And we raised well over $10,000 for a children's hospital in Ramallah, which I felt was incredibly important, because even though we were being demonized by the press, even though they were out there saying, oh, you guys are funding terrorism, by what? By keeping four-year-old children alive? We're funding terrorism? Every opportunity that they take, the devil is going to throw something at me, and that's fine. I recently was working with a group called Omade International, and we're not ready to announce it, but we have the plans and work to build an orphanage in Afghanistan near Kabul for the children that are victims of the war, as we put it. Because in this country, there's a very different understanding of what homelessness is. You know, in America or England, if there's a homeless child on the street, you see a homeless motherfucker here and there, but you see a homeless child on the street, and you know that CPS, or the equivalent of that here in London, is coming to get that child. That somewhere, at some point, they might not be in the best place, but they'll be in some sort of foster care or in the charge of the authorities. But in a country like Afghanistan, or a country like Iraq, or a country that doesn't have a specific structure because it's been overthrown, that child is going to be kidnapped and sold into slavery, into the sex trade. You know what I mean? Something horrible and disgusting, and it's going to be supported by rich white businessmen that come from countries like this. No matter how fucked up we think we have it in our hood, somebody in another hood is suffering 10 times worse. Somebody in a hood in Pakistan, somebody in a hood in India, somebody in a hood in South Africa, somebody in Brazil knows a poverty that is in another dimension than to what we know. And those, what goes on in those countries directly impacts what we have here, whether we like to believe it or not. Because sometimes we like to forget and turn our back to it as if we're not part of that struggle, as if that's not part of the world. We think because we live in the empire that that shit doesn't affect us. You know, the Romans thought like that once about the Goths and the Vandals, and they got fucked over it. So I suggest that we learn from history, lest we become doomed to repeat it again. I think apathy is the enemy. I think that people that say, oh, I'm conscious, that doesn't imply you're going to do anything, brother. That's a main issue that I have. People that romanticize revolution. Because it's not just rich white businessmen. We can't blame America, the great Satan, for everything. You know, I think that what needs to take place is that we not only confront the enemies around the world that we see in corporate greed or the violation of human rights by government organizations or the placation of our people in our society, but also confront an enemy within ourselves. I've learned that it's very hard to be a rock star and a revolutionary. Those two things don't go together. You know, music is incredibly self-absorbing. It makes you kind of selfish and self-absorbed and nothing else fucking matters. And, you know, you focus so much on it that your personal relationships suffer because of it. And at the same time, a revolutionary's life is selfless. He lives for the people and for the struggle. So it's hard to be torn between those two worlds. I think that the greatest enemy is not just other people, but within ourselves. And we need to be able to identify that. You know, in the Quran, for example, it says the jinn is a creature of smokeless fire. That's what he comes from. You know, when you feel jealousy and hatred and anger, it burns inside you, right? But it's not noticeable sometimes. You don't give off smoke. What is smoke? You can smell smoke and you can see it. It's the greatest warning of danger and trouble, because fire leaves nothing in its wake and it burns completely because it consumes everything it touches. So since there's no visible aspect of that in the character of a person that really has those sort of personal demons within them, a lot of times it takes extra steps for us to be able to confront that within ourselves. Because that is the greatest enemy sometimes that I think we have. That is the greatest jihad. That is the greatest struggle. Before we engage in the idea about a violent revolution, we have to engage in the idea about an economic revolution, a cultural revolution, one that we control the local politics before we dream about controlling every other aspect of everything around us. Before we say, hey, we're taking this country over, let's say, can we empower ourselves to efficiently run a district or a town? Can we empower ourselves as a people to change our minds about the way that society is run? And I would say this extra, that if it does boil down to a physical revolution, that we have to understand what's risked there. Because in every single revolution that's ever come through the course of time, even for the most justified reasons, or for the most selfish reasons, whether it was a Chinese revolution or a Cuban revolution, whether it was a Haitian revolution or it was a French revolution, I think that you have to know that innocent people have been murdered, innocent women have been raped, people's property has been confiscated illegally and never returned, people have had their culture and their struggles marginalized. And it's interesting to note that in a revolution, people know that and they understand it. They understand the risks that they're facing, even in some small way, but they're willing to take that risk. They're willing to put up everything on the line, to risk their lives completely, just so they can gamble it in the main hopes that it will bring a different life to their people. And it's for many reasons. It's because the government has become so abusive and so blatant with what they do that it leaves them with no other choice but to do that. And in America, I think it's different because there are so many ways in which we're pacified, in which we're placated, either with entertainment or sports. It's almost as if the government's designed to try and make us feel enough indignation where they can get away with whatever they want to, but not push us so far that it becomes impossible for us to broker it in our heads that we have to go back to living under their system of rule. Racism was a creation. And that while racism doesn't really capture the full scope of oppression, racism doesn't unfortunately exist. We can't deny that. But race in itself does not, because we are one human race of people. You know, if we copulate with a woman of a different ethnicity, we don't create some half-breed freak. We create another human life, another human being. And I think that what we need to understand is that even though race doesn't exist, sometime in the very near future, race will exist. And that racism will exist to another degree because different human races will exist. If the scientific advancements that we make go unchecked, and that if we do not regulate them, not for religious reasons, but for the moral foundation of our human structure, then one day there will be a race of people that are so genetically modified that they say to themselves, you know what, I don't get AIDS like you people. I don't get cancer like you motherfuckers. No, I've been modified when I was a child. Your parents, some of y'all were willing to spend 40,000 pounds to give you a great education because they thought it would give you a greater chance in the marketplace. So what happens when a parent is faced with the fact that they can invest 30,000 pounds in you when you're an embryo to give you a better chance for longer life? To modify you to the point where you don't get these diseases that other people get. Where you're not as susceptible to levels of cold and hot temperature, so that when the world changes, because we've learned one thing, that everything changes, and this world's temperature will change, this environment will change, and only the people who are modified or structured to change with it will change. And those people will not be determined by the color of their skin, but by the class that they belong to. That will define the future of all humanity.
Okay, inspiring stuff. Next up, we have Dean from We Are Change UK, who is also the director of the documentary The Elephant in the Room. You can see the film for free at nosmokewithoutfire.co.uk, and it's a film which simply tells the story of the truth movement and the first responders without proposing any kind of theories. There's no speed of free fall in this documentary. But it does feature a wide range of credible figures who set out a compelling case for reinvestigation of 9/11. Before that, though, Gareth continues his correspondence with the anti-terrorism hotline.
Hello, sorry, is that the terrorist hotline?
Yes, indeed.
Hello, I am phoning up. I phoned it up a couple of times, actually.
Sure.
To just discuss a couple of things. But essentially, I'm an activist.
Uh-huh.
And I've been researching the events of September the 11th and the 7/7 bombings.
Sure.
And I've come to some serious conclusions, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
And
have you published your conclusions?
Have I published my conclusions?
Uh-huh.
Where would you recommend
them?
Well, no,
in the press, or have you published them anyway?
Well, no, I'm not a journalist.
Uh-huh.
I've told people, I've met people that have also researched mm-hmm. it and come to very similar conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
I've approached a gentleman called Mr. Peter Power, who was running the terror exercises on 7/7.
Sure.
And he refused to answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. So what would you like me to do?
Well, I've gone to your website and it says, we are responsible for keeping the UK safe from any threat to our national security.
That's
correct. We work with the police and security agencies to ensure that we can do all we can to prevent any harm coming to our country and our people. And it says what we are doing to keep the UK safe. Since the terrorist attacks on the United States on September 11th, 2001, we have substantially increased our counter-terrorism efforts and our planning for what happens when an emergency occurs. But it's all a complete waste of time. If you
uh-huh.
if you look at the evidence with a couple of hours of your time with an open mind, you'll come to pretty much the same conclusion.
Just elaborate on your conclusion. What's your name, sorry, and then I'll be able to...
Well, can I take your name as well?
Yeah, my name's Kate.
My name's Gareth.
Gareth.
Yeah.
Okay, Gareth. So what have you concluded then?
Well, I have concluded that there is a historical... what's the word? It happened throughout history. It's a technique that's used by governments, corporations, and organizations, and it's called false flag terrorism. False flag terrorism.
Uh-huh.
And it's where a government, a corporation, or an organization carry out an attack, blame it on their enemy in order to go to war or start conflict with their enemy.
Yeah.
And the evidence is quite clear. If you look at it with an open mind, the evidence regarding 9/11 is unanimous amongst people that, like architects and engineers, physicists, even people that work in the military, intelligence professionals.
Yes.
Because buildings do not come down, the fire does not get hot enough, and the building came down into itself at three full speeds. That defies physics.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite well documented, that theory, isn't it? That it was like pyrotechnics. Is that what they call it? That, you know...
Controlled demolition.
Yes. Well, I don't know the scientific way of it. Yeah. So it is nothing... it's not a new idea in the arena, is it?
Well, it's gathering speeds.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy theory, isn't it?
Well, the official theory is also a conspiracy theory, and it's unproven, because two more people conspiring to commit a crime is a conspiracy. So... Mm. Whether it's an Arab conspiracy or it's a conspiracy by the military-industrial complex, it's a conspiracy regardless
well,
of that.
Well, Gareth, the only thing I can do is put your concerns down
and
forward them on to the head of the terrorism command.
Yeah, will that person contact me?
That's what I don't know. I'm like a messenger here.
Okay.
That's all I can do. Now, would you give me your contact details? You don't have to, but...
What kind of contact details would you
like? A telephone number.
Yeah, you can have my telephone number if you want.
Okay. What's your address?
Can I not give my address?
No, I'm happy with that. And Gareth, do you want to give me your surname or just keep your first name?
First name. But I'm not really satisfied. I'm very much aware that Muslims had nothing to do with 9/11. I know, I'm very much aware that this entire war on terror, which is a war of terror, which has resulted in the deaths of over a million people, has nothing to do with Muslims. So you people run a service for the public to give information about terrorism. I'm giving you information, and I would like someone to call me back.
Yes, that's all I can do is take your query from here, pass it on, and hopefully someone will call you back.
I very much appreciate that.
Okay, Gareth.
What was your name again?
Kate.
Kate. All right, thank you very much.
No trouble. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi there, you're listening to Dean Puckett on We Are Change podcast with the elephant in the room. My section of the show will be a little bit of an eclectic one this time, made up of sort of bits and bobs which didn't quite make it into the film but are absolutely vital and interesting, which are all part of extras on the DVD. You can watch the whole film online for free at nosmokewithoutfire.co.uk. The first section of the show will be We Are Change in New York, walking around the streets of New York and going to various different places and protesting for various different reasons. I picked up with the guys outside the Council on Foreign Relations. The first person you'll hear is Luke Wadowski. He explains what their motivations are for being outside the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, this is the Pratt House, Council on Foreign Relations, where you have people from Zbigniew Brzezinski, David Rockefeller, basically setting American foreign policy, and this is where they institute the New World Order through American policy. Yo, guys, you can't block pedestrian traffic. Move that over there. Sorry about that, but this is the criminal elite courthouse where they justify open borders, a one world order, one currency, and they write open policy papers about a North American Union. They were the key founding members of the EU, and they're big criminal elites that want a one world government, and that's why we're out here.
I was actually going to start going to the army when my cousin introduced me to News Change.
Oh, wow.
And then I was actually sick at that time too, so I was in my bed watching News Change, and I have had pretty much nothing else to do except for accept the truth that there were a lot of situations, a lot of things, a lot of events that were happening where I couldn't justify that it happened through natural effects, that there had to be an inside job, there had to be some kind of different answer that wasn't provided by the regular media.
The laws of physics stood down on September 11th, according to their story. You know, Osama bin Laden, yes, he may have some really intense contact laws of physics. That's just basic. So, yeah, I mean, ever since the day of, they pumped out the official narrative. And we shouldn't even call it the official narrative. We should just call it the government's whack conspiracy garbage. And that's what it was. Listen to your president, right? What did he say? He's like, well, we shall never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories about the attacks of September 11th, right? Listen to your president. He's not my president, but, you know, listen to him.
I've been in this since 2001. I used to be Alex Jones's radio producer. My name's Kevin Smith. So once you get a certain way into this, you can't back off. They don't have to hear me say it or Luke say it. Everybody knows something's wrong. Everybody can sense something's wrong. So, and the more we do this, the more acceptable it is for other people to think, I can get involved and not have to be in fear.
It was not an inside job. How could it be an inside job? Who would obviously kill 3,000, indiscriminate American people? Who would do that? What would they gain by, even if they want to start a war? Which they did, by the way.
Those guys are saying that you should investigate 9/11 and you should just do your own research. 9/11. All they're asking for is for a new investigation.
Do you agree with those guys, yeah?
I definitely do. I've been studying it for 2 years, and all the evidence show that there was definitely a lot that we weren't told about September 11th.
Turn your TV set off. CNN has nothing but lies for you.
You refuse to cover the Bin Laden CIA connections. You refuse to cover the head of Pakistani intelligence, the man who wired $100,000 to Muhammad Atta, the fact that he was in Washington, D.C. on the morning of September 11th. I never heard about that in the news.
They're the only people telling the truth. I saw 9/11 happen. Those were fighter planes made to look like commercial jets. There were no people inside those planes that hit the towers. There weren't any. Those were fighter planes. I saw it happen. George Bush is a thief and a liar, and Dick Cheney is a murdering Nazi bastard, and they both need to be thrown in jail or banished to Marlon Brando Island, where they have to sit and stare at one another for all eternity as their punishment. I hate those lying pigs. and this whole shit with Osama bin Laden, every time we get ready to impeach them, they pull out the booger man. Look, booger man's gonna get you. Look, booger man gonna get you. If you talk this kind of thing in like Mexico or in Central America or South America or anywhere else in the world, and you say, listen, the government did this, they'll say, oh, totally. But people in America, they can't believe that their own government would conspire against them.
Why do you think that is?
Because they're like little kids. You can trick them with smoke and mirrors and candy, and they, and TV is God here in America, and they don't listen to anything. They just, whatever TV says, that's the truth.
Most of the people who know 9/11 is an inside job, and this is not a dig on them. This is just a statement of fact. They spend most of their time sitting down on their computer. Okay? If every single person that knew 9/11 was an inside job was out on the street, this whole thing would be over in a week. You know? So what we do is we get out on our feet and, you know, take to the streets and hand stuff out, whether it's flyers, whether it's DVDs, and we get our cameras in our hand, and we do things that the press won't do. You know, we talk to the politicians, we talk to the oligarchs, and ask them the tough questions.
This may be your first opportunity, but make sure that it is not your last. Start somewhere. Start with two things, people, if you've never worked at 9/11 before. World Trade Center number 7. This is a building that collapsed at 5:20 p.m. Eastern. This is the third building to collapse on September 11th. The funny thing is, this building was never hit by a plane. This September 11th, 3 days from now, you are going to see thousands of people on the streets, and you're going to recognize that we will no longer remain silent. Because this movement has begun. And this is not the end, this is surely the beginning.
I have looked into all of the relevant evidence. I have read the best 9/11 books out there, the one by Webster Griffin Tarpley, by Michael Rupert, David Ray Griffin. The science points to explosions. Certainly you can't fake physics, to my knowledge. I'm not a scientist, but as I know. And also to my knowledge, the laws of physics don't make exceptions, even if you wave a box cutter at them. From what I understand. Now, as to the war, we went over there supposedly to get Osama bin Laden. Now, the person telling us that we had to go get Osama bin Laden is an ally to the bin Laden family, George Bush. So that was strange in and of itself. Then when you consider the fact that they are no longer interested in getting Osama bin Laden. Where is he? Nobody seems to care. He was the reason given for why we had to go to war. Many people have lost their lives across the world, those fighting and those defending their freedoms, even innocent women and children who had nothing to do with anything. And yet, the reason given, the motive given for why this had to occur was this one man, Osama bin Laden, and his organization, Al-Qaeda. Yet all of a sudden, that doesn't matter.
The second section of my podcast this month features Cynthia McKinney talking about Operation Northwoods.
There's a document. That was made public by James Bamford, an investigative journalist who used to be with ABC News. And it's the Operation Northwoods documents. Now, Operation Northwoods was a terrorist attack on the United States that was conceived by the U.S. military. The purpose of Operation Northwoods was to scare the American people into having a war against Castro's Cuba that the Pentagon planners wanted. They knew they couldn't get it just by saying we want to go to war. So they drew up these plans to wreak terror on the streets of the United States. those plans included airplanes, hijacking, downing airplanes, and then blaming it on Castro and launching a war against Cuba. That was the vision of Operation Northwoods. The Joint Chiefs of Staff even talked about in this document making sure that the timing was such that they could raise U.S. the ire of the population, which meant maybe it would be a good idea to have university students on these planes so that that would increase the outrage. This is the U.S. military actually making plans to launch a reign of terror against the American people. The only thing that stood between Cuba, the American people, and those military planners was President John F. Kennedy, who said no. Now that's a fact. Once we know that fact, we know that anything else lies within the realm of possibility.
The third section of my podcast this month features John Feel talking about the plight of the first responders. These guys need help now. Go to feelgoodfoundation.com, F-E-A-L, goodfoundation.com. Help them out. Make a donation.
We wouldn't be in existence. We wouldn't be in business. That actually care and want to help us, but their hands are tied because the rest of the Senate and Congress doesn't care about heroes of 9/11. So while they fight in Washington for our rights, more and more 9/11 responders get sick and die. There's no money and no pill in the world that's going to save their lives now, but they need to be compensated. They need to be able to pay their medical bills. They need to be able to pay their pharmaceutical needs. They need to put food on the table for their families. And someone needs to step up in Washington, apologize. And someone needs to grow a set of Abe Lincolns and do the right thing, which is to help heroes on 9/11 who are sick and dying. This is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. This is not blue, red, state, whatever. This is human life. We're talking human life. And when human life takes a backseat to economics and the almighty dollar, there's a problem. There is a problem. This country's run on corruption and greed, and we live in a time now where politics and religion divide each. I believe the goodness in people will unite us again, and that might be naive and that might be gullible, but I strongly believe in everything I'm doing and showing that just the pure goodness in people will be contagious and it will spread to the next person, will make us a better country once again, because it's the American people. And like in every other country, it's the people of that country that make that country great, not the governments. I don't know what happens when people get elected into office that they actually turn off the switch of compassion towards human life, because too many people are sick and dying. It's not just 9/11. It's the soldiers fighting over in Iraq when they come home, Katrina. This current administration's lack of compassion has trickled into society. And Americans poop on each other now. We don't care about each other. We need to get that spirit back, because 200 years ago when they formed this country, it was based on volunteers. You got a lot of volunteers in the war from Katrina or 9/11 that need your help. The rest of the world needs to know that these people are your friends. They hold no grudges against the rest of the world. And if you had a disaster in your country, they would be there to help you. But it's our government that's giving us a black eye. And that's a shame. And that's un-American.
That's it, the elephant in the room. You can watch the whole film online for free at nosmokewithoutfire.co.uk. Watch it online, download it, copy it, give it to your friends and family, get the word out, tell them about the first responders, tell them about Cynthia McKinney.
Hello?
Hello, can I help you?
Yes. I am phoning because I've researched the events of 7/7 and 9/11, and I am quite aware that the entire thing's a fraud.
Okay.
So I'm just a little bit curious about the purpose of your phone service.
Not for you to keep bothering us, probably.
Well, but we're in the... Oh, hello?
Well, next up, we're going to talk to an articulate, erudite campaigner for 9/11 Truth, our very own Mohsin from We Are Change UK. You can see him making pure intelligent sense about the false, prescriptive nature of the war on terror on YouTube and on our website, wearechange.org.uk. You can also read his articles about the war on terror and the propaganda model on our website. And in a minute, you can listen to his recent exchange with leading left liberal author and columnist George Monbiot. Now, Mohsin has taken his rhetorical skills with him to Paris, but thanks to two changed hands and a very long piece of string, we managed to catch up with him recently. Well, you've taken your skills and your knowledge to Paris with you. Tell me, are you still putting them to good use for the truth movement?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, I've come over here on work, so I'm going to be here for a couple of years now, I think. And, you know, well, I guess one of the advantages of me coming over here is that we can take We Are Change and some of its precepts, which are pretty new, I guess, in the activist world. We can start them off in the first We Are Change in a non-English speaking country. So it's good to get that started. So we've been going now for, I guess, 2 or 3 months maybe. And it hasn't all been plain sailing. It's been a little bit, we've had a few trials and tribulations. But we've basically, I think now we've kind of put our house in order. And I think that from now on, I guess starting with this 11th anniversary, we should start getting strength to strength.
Now, recently you had an interesting little debate with George Monbiot, a leading influential environmental and left liberal author, campaigner and columnist. Give us some background here, Mohsin. Who is he and what made you want to engage with him on 9/11 Truth?
Well, basically, he is probably in the UK the sort of leading critic of the 9/11 Truth movement. When I say critic, I mean, I guess I always say that within 9/11 Truth, you have three groups of people. You have people who know the facts and would class themselves as 9/11 truthers. You have people who don't know the facts and are opposed to 9/11 Truth. And then you have a minute group, which are people who know the facts and still oppose the 9/11 Truth movement. And I guess George Monbiot is the most prominent one of those people, and he's written two articles in The Guardian, sort of slating the movement, describing Loose Change as a virus that was sweeping the world. And he went on national radio and debated David Ray Griffin, and he again criticised Loose Change Final Cut. And I kind of got the feeling that he didn't have too much of an idea what he was talking about in terms of knowing what the 9/11 Truth movement was, and knowing what it stood for, knowing what the arguments were, so on and so forth. So I kind of wanted to engage him and see what an obviously fairly intelligent guy, you know, when probed a little bit and when pressed on a few points, we have to say for himself.
Before we hear your little tete-a-tete with Monbiot, tell us, what on earth does the word propitious mean? Because let's face it, listeners are going to need to know.
It means favourable. Favourable is probably the best definition.
Favourable. Okay, so everyone, sit back, relax, and enjoy Mohsin versus Monbiot.
Okay, George, well, let's start off by defining our terms, if we could. The Truth Movement maintains that there is sufficient evidence of criminal complicity in 9/11 on the part of the US government, so much so that there needs to be a new transparent investigation into this. Now, your stance is, I guess it's a little bit more nuanced than most opponents of the Truth Movement, in that you do believe that there have been sort of cover-ups and that there were massive warnings and the US took no steps to respond to those warnings. Is that correct?
That's correct. I believe that there was plenty of evidence to suggest that there was an imminent danger, and that the US failed to respond to those signals. I also think that the Bush administration is culpable of failing to protect the people of New York from the toxic fumes emanating from the site,
yeah,
and also of using
coming back to your position on the criminal negligence, one of the things I have a little bit of difficulty understanding is how such a position can coexist with the fact, which you're almost certainly aware, that in September 2000, Project for New American Century, which was essentially the Bush administration-to-be, published their document Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which they stated that a new Pearl Harbor would be propitious to policy. Because there what you have is you have the neoconservatives coming out and saying, wouldn't it be great if we had a new Pearl Harbor? You have, as you've stated, criminal negligence in failing to prevent this new Pearl Harbor. But yet your position is that these two incidents don't, this connection doesn't need to be investigated. There's nothing there to see. How do you justify that?
Okay, well, I haven't seen this document which talks about a new Pearl Harbor, so I'm not sure exactly how they would have put it. Were they saying, if such a thing were to happen, we should capitalize on it, or we are really hoping that such a thing will happen?
Well, I can give you the sort of direct quote in the direct context. Yeah, the direct quote is, the document is called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's essentially the War on Terror, blueprinted, prescripted beforehand, talking about the need to invade Iraq, to militarize the planet, to essentially to rebuild America's defenses, to preserve American hegemony for the 21st century. And what they state is that in order to achieve this, the direct quote is, to achieve this in a timely fashion, they say, the process of transformation will be long, absent a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. So there you essentially have a recommendation of a new Pearl Harbor. You then have criminal negligence on the part of those people who stated this, as you have identified. But in your eyes, there's no need for an investigation into the connect between the two.
Well, let's start with something on which I'm sure we can both agree, that the people who were instrumental in the Project for a New American Century and in the Bush administration are a scheming, cynical, devious, ruthless, manipulative group.
Right.
One of the most unpleasant governments the world has seen since the time of the Borgias.
Okay.
Of course, it's absolutely true that they would capitalize on any and every event which would enable them to enhance their power. And it's very interesting, for instance, how Naomi Klein documents this in her book, The Shock Doctrine.
Right.
Showing that wherever there is a crisis around the world, they will parachute in their neoliberal economists and say, oh, we can take over this economy for you and turn it round to suit their purposes.
Okay.
Now, the question that arises from that document is, does this mean they were planning a new Pearl Harbor, or does this mean that if such a thing were to arise, they would capitalize on it? And from what you've just read to me, it sounds more like the latter, that that unless a new Pearl Harbor happens, this is going to be a long, slow, hard struggle. But if it does, well, hey, we're in business.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that they are necessarily going to be the ones who create that new Pearl Harbor. And I think the danger you potentially reveal in the way you put this is adding two and two to make five, is saying, here are these people hoping that there would be a crisis they would capitalize on. This crisis comes along as a result of a failure on the part of the state to perform the necessary policing actions. Therefore, they must have precipitated it. Now, that's a very big leap from one position to the other.
I think,
to justify that leap, you would require some pretty compelling evidence.
I think that my position is actually a little bit more nuanced than that, George. I mean, what we have is the fact that, as I've stated, they recommended the occurrence of a new Pearl Harbor, where they state its favorability. Then, as you say...
Let's get this straight, because from what you've read me, it doesn't sound like they were recommending the occurrence of it. They weren't saying, we want to engineer this.
They were stating it would be propitious to policy.
They were saying, yes, exactly. Wouldn't it be good if this happened?
Right, okay.
Which is a different position.
Okay. Well, let's be clear about that then. They said it would be propitious to policy if a new Pearl Harbor were to occur. Then, as you have identified, they were... let's be clear about a new Pearl Harbor. A new Pearl Harbor isn't something that happens every day. This is a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. And also, I mean, I'll send you the document afterwards if you want to read it. They're very specific about, even about time frames. They state that the Quadrennial Defense Review, sort of the four-year a review which states military posture should be for the next 4 years, is coming up in October 2001, and it would be good if these ideas that we present were in the head of the president and decision makers by that time. So they state a specific time frame for a once-in-a-lifetime event, or they suggest a specific time frame.
You're saying they're stating that time frame for the new Pearl Harbor, but you've just been describing something else that they were stating the time frame for. I mean, you're talking about a new defense review. That's surely got nothing to do with this new Pearl Harbor review.
No.
Are they in the same paragraph?
Quite to the contrary. It has exactly the same thing to do with it, because the document is stating what needs to be done. The new Pearl Harbor statement states how it can be done and soon. And the facts about the quadrennial defense review occurring in October 2001, the point about that is that this is when the suggestions that we present in this document should be implemented by that time. And so the best way for that to happen, the most propitious way for that to happen, logically we can deduce, would be if a new Pearl Harbor were to occur prior to the quadrennial defense review, so the policies they suggest can be implemented in the best way possible. That's going by their logic, not going by mine.
Okay, this is where it starts to get slightly comical. In order to influence the outcome of a defense review in October 2001, you would engineer this massive and incredibly dangerous and extremely risky event which will kill thousands of people. I mean, that event, as you know well, completely superseded any defense review which would have taken place in October 2001. It was far, far bigger than that. If you wanted to influence the outcome of a quadrennial defense review in October 2001, they had 100 backdoor lobbying ways of doing that. What you're talking about, the attack on 9/11, was on a completely different scale altogether. So the idea that that attack would have been generated in order to influence a defense review, which these guys from the Project for New American Century had their hands on already. I mean, let's not forget that Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Feith, all these people in the Pentagon, the three top guys in the Pentagon, were all members of the Project for a New American Century.
Precisely.
So, in other words, in order to influence themselves to produce the favorable defense review that they wanted, they had to orchestrate 9/11. It's preposterous. If they wanted a favorable quadrennial defense review, they just had to write it.
I think, but there are two slightly different things there, George. I mean, they can go ahead and they can have in mind what they want to do, but it's a very different thing wanting to invade Iraq. And we know this from practice. It's a very different thing from wanting to invade Iraq and having a pretext on which you can convince the public and the Senate and the political powers, to go along with your plan to invade Iraq. And it's not just the invasion of Iraq. It's the creation of a never-ending series of strategic radicalization. It's the creation of the war on terror. The war on terror, which is, I mean, it's the successor to the Cold War. It's an excuse for never-ending invasion of countries, seizing resources, so on and so forth, to prolong American hegemony, as has been stated in the document. But getting back to the point, I mean, the point is that a new Pearl Harbor is such an unlikely event, it's a once-in-a-lifetime event. It was deemed to be propitious by the people who are running the Bush administration on and up to 9/11, who are charged with preventing such an attack against the US on and up to 9/11, and who were, in your eyes, criminally negligent in failing to do so. Now, what I would like to know is how those two beliefs can coexist. How you can recognize, if you do recognize, I'll send you the document, as I said, that the people who are protecting the US deemed a new Pearl Harbor to be favorable policy, that they were then criminally negligent in failing to stop it, but there's no need for a criminal investigation into the connection between the two.
Oh, I think there's absolutely a need for an investigation into why, a much more thorough one, into why the security authorities were so blinking hopeless that they didn't respond to what, in retrospect, we could see were very clearly articulated threats. And I mean, there has been, some heads have rolled as a result of that, but rather late in the day, and not necessarily all the heads which should have rolled. But that's a completely different matter from saying that those same people actually orchestrated 9/11. I mean, that's a completely different set of claims.
How do you define
that? To say that they were negligent, grossly negligent, in not responding to clear warnings, and, you know, part of the problem here was that those warnings weren't passed up the chain sufficiently, that you had junior FBI agents who were aware of problems, and they told their immediate bosses, and their immediate bosses failed to respond to all the sort of cock-ups which happen within any bureaucracy, but especially such a top-heavy bureaucracy as the security services in the United States.
how do you define made 9/11 happen?
Well, that's the question that I would put to you.
Well, I mean,
I don't know exactly what shade of opinion within the 9/11 truth movement you represent, but what I've seen from this movement is a welter of claims, often contradictory, some of which say, well, they deliberately turned a blind eye, they knew it was going to happen, and they wanted the terrorists to succeed in their attacks, which was why they let that happen, all the way to it was Bush and Cheney what did it, and they actually orchestrated the entire conspiracy and were directly responsible for recruiting the terrorists who carried it out.
The ultimate point.
So the question I'd ask you is to position yourself on that axis, and then we can talk about your particular set of beliefs.
Well, this is why I defined our terms at the start, because the position of the truth movement, though I guess it's a wide spectrum with many sort of position with many sort of positions or ideas along that spectrum, it all comes down to the same baseline proposition, which is that there is sufficient evidence of criminal complicity on behalf of the US government to warrant a new independent investigation into 9/11, into this complicity. That's what it is. And whether you believe that it was, they were flying the planes, or Bush was flying the planes, or whatever you believe, whatever your position on that spectrum, it all comes down to the same base principle. And one of the elements, one of the positions in which I've done a lot of research and looked into, is the element of PNAC. Because for me, it's inconceivable that a once-in-a-lifetime event could be essentially advocated or deemed to be favorable by the people who are in charge of protecting the country from such an event. Then they could be criminal negligent in failing to stop that. And then we can just say, oh, nothing to see there. There's nothing to look at there. I think that's the height of negligence on the part of the public and on the part of journalists too, because if this is true, it would be the crime of the century, and it's something that would need to be looked into. If I could pass on to, go ahead. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
A couple of things that came up there, because I was asking you something in order to respond to it.
Sure.
By all means, I mean, I don't believe that the 9/11 Commission had the last word on anything, and I would like, just like you, to see a much more thorough and wide-ranging inquiry, which is far more proactive in looking at the failures of the chains of command and all the rest of it. But it does strike me that you are hanging an awful lot of weight on one sentence in a report by this Project for a New American Century. And I'd say two things about that. First off, that sentence could be, and on the face of it, is pure wishful thinking. Wouldn't it be great if? Now, it's a sort of thing which a lot of us who are involved in commentary do all the time. And I'm often saying in my columns, we can pursue this policy, but if the circumstances were right and, for instance, such and such were to happen, we could pursue a different policy. And that doesn't mean that I'm the one who's going to make that thing happen to create those circumstances. That is a rather different matter. But the other thing I'd say is that if that was really what they were doing, if they were really planning a new Pearl Harbor, why on earth would they tell us that in a publicly available document?
I would say that that's a question you'd have to ask them, because I wasn't the one who wrote it.
It only is a question you have to ask them if you can sustain the assumption that they were actually planning it. But, I mean, it seems, again, highly unlikely to me that if that were their actual policy, that they would breathe a word of it in any forum, let alone in a publicly available document. And I think you're actually leaping on this, which is a very flimsy line of evidence, because it sounds to me just like they're saying, it'd be wonderful if this opportunity presented itself, rather than saying we're going to create this opportunity. And you're leaping on this one sentence and hanging an entire theory off it.
Well, I mean, it's just one element of my argument. If we could move on to another point, as has been documented in Loose Change Final Cut, which I know you've seen, the attacks of 9/11 were, to a significant degree, I mean, they cost $500,000 to execute, according to Tom Keene. $100,000 of this came from Mahmoud Ahmed, who is the head of the Pakistani ISI. This has been reported by the Times of India, Agence France-Presse, Wall Street Journal, confirmed by the FBI. Now, Mahmoud Ahmed, who was one of the chief, who was therefore one of the chief financiers of 9/11, spent the week of 9/11 in Washington meeting with senior intelligence and State Department officials, people such as Mark Grossman, George Tenet. And on the morning of 9/11, he was having breakfast with Porter Goss and Bob Graham. So therefore, you have the one of the chief financiers of an attack that was deemed to be favorable by the administration, meeting on the week of that attack with members of the intelligence community of that administration on the week of that attack. And yet you don't deem that to be worthy of any sort of criminal investigation or even of suspicion. Can you outline your position there?
Well, you say that I don't deem it to be this and deem it to be that. I'm not sure I've expressed an opinion.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've expressed your opinion of opposition to the Truth Movement. This is quite a key element. It's detailed in Loose Change Final Cut, one of the most prominent films. So I assume that you would have a position on it.
If it can be sustained that this man was indeed the major financier, and you haven't given me anything which sounds like proof, though obviously several people have made the allegation, then that certainly warrants very vigorous investigation indeed.
Right.
But I'm afraid it won't be the first time that men of that caliber have been entertained in Washington. We've seen a perpetual cycle of tyrants and despots and sponsors of state terrorism and other forms of terrorism passing through the White House. It happens all the time. Leaders of death squads from Colombia.
Of course.
And lavishly there.
Mm-hmm.
We saw under Reagan a perpetual engagement with people who you would consider rightly as guilty of terrorism from Central America being entertained here. I mean, all sorts of villains and rogues are perpetually cycled through the White House and Capitol Hill because they are allies.
Of course.
Of this very corrupt and unpleasant government.
Mm-hmm.
And now that doesn't mean that you can say, aha, because this guy was there, therefore they were conspiring together on this particular issue.
That's not what I'm saying.
They were conspiring together, but it could have been on one of any number of issues.
No, that's not what I'm saying, George. What I'm saying is that the financier of these attacks which were deemed favourable by the government...
First of all, you assume that he is the financier of these attacks.
But hang on, George. But I'm going by... Who am I going? I'm going by the FBI. I'm going by Wall Street Journal, Agence France-Presse. I mean...
Now, tell me what the FBI has said.
I don't have the direct quote on me.
Well, you see, this is where the problem lies.
But... So I'm sorry, Joe, but I'm not a walking encyclopedia. I can send you the sources after this interview if you like.
This sounds like it's absolutely critical to your argument. Surely it lies at the centre. If you are saying that the FBI has identified this man as the primary sponsor of the 9/11 terrorists...
I didn't say the primary sponsor. I said $100,000 out of the $500,000.
Okay, well, okay. As a man who contributed a very substantial portion of their funding, that would be... That's an incredibly powerful line of evidence. It should be on the tip of your tongue. You should be able to give me chapter and verse on that straight away.
Well, excuse me for my deficiency in that particular point, but I have the name of the source. And as I said, I'm not a walking encyclopedia. What I can do is I can email you the quotes afterwards, and then you can give me your thoughts on it. I can email you the documents, the references, so on and so forth. This has been fairly widely reported. Sorry.
Because you can't. We're having this discussion right now. And, of course, I'd like to see that stuff. But because you cannot currently give me chapter and verse on that, it doesn't have any status at the moment within this discussion.
Incidentally, the
FBI says, who in the FBI, where in the FBI, what document is it in, what is the precise nature of the allegation, what is that allegation based on? All those questions have to be answered before you can say, this man gave £100,000 to the terrorists.
Mm.
And even then, of course, even if you can supply that information, and we'll see if you can, but even if you can supply that information, of course, unless there has been an investigation and hopefully a trial and all the rest of it, then you still can't say definitively that he was responsible.
I'm not trying to say definitively. I said this at the start. The point of the Truth Movement isn't to prove X, Y, and Z. I can't subpoena documents. I can't make Dick Cheney swear under oath. What we do is we amass... a significant proportion of evidence that points to one conclusion. And this is one such example.
Exactly where the problem lies. You did say that he was the sponsor. You just told me I can't say definitively that he was. You did say definitively that he was.
Yeah, I can say definitively that he wasn't the sponsor, but what you're saying is, what I understood you were saying was that I can't, can I definitively prove that that means it was an inside job? That's something that I can't definitively
do. No, sorry, there's a direct contradiction here. You just said that you cannot definitively say that this man was a sponsor.
No, that I can definitively say. What I can't definitively
before
say...
Before then you said that you couldn't.
No. I misunderstood you, maybe. What I can't definitively say is whether that proves that 9/11 was an inside job. That's
you made these series of leaps, these series of wild suppositions, which then get turned in your mind and in that of the rest of the truth movement, into incontrovertible fact.
What supposition? What supposition have I made?
The supposition you have made here is that this man was one of the primary sponsors of the 9/11 terrorists.
No, but that's not my supposition.
You haven't actually provided me with any evidence to suggest that that is the case.
That's not my supposition. That's something that's been reported by the FBI, the Times of India, Agence France Presse, and the Wall Street Journal, and others. I'll send you the links afterwards if you like. I don't have the quotes on me.
An awful lot of things published in all those outlets which turn out to be completely untrue. Now, so what you can...
But then what qualifies for evidence, George?
What you could reasonably say in this circumstance is there have been serious allegations made concerning the a suggestion that this man was a sponsor of terrorism, a sponsor of the 9/11 terrorists. What you cannot say on the basis of what you told me was this man was definitively a sponsor of the 9/11 terrorists. And this is what I'm saying. It's all about quality of evidence, and it's all about the conclusions that you can draw from the evidence available. And it's a very good example, I think, of what's wrong with this 9/11 truth movement, that it takes quotes from a newspaper, quotes from the Times of India, quotes from Agence France Presse, and treats them as if they are the word of God, as if they are the end of the matter. That is now settled. We now know that this man was a major sponsor of terrorism because the Times of India says so. Well, I'm sorry, but you need a heck of a lot stronger evidence than that.
Right. Okay. Well, we can move on. We can. I'll send you the documents and the links, and you can judge for yourself. If I can ask two more questions. Basically, one, looking at a detail, I know you. This was brought up in your debate with David Ray Griffin, and that's the testimony of Barry Jennings and Michael Hess, who were the two State Department officials in Building 7, who reported a massive explosion happening on the sixth floor of Building 7, just after 9 o'clock on the morning of 9/11. Now, why do you feel this isn't worthy of... I mean, I'm assuming, again, that you don't feel this is worthy of investigation. Why do you not feel this to be the case?
You're assuming all sorts of things which aren't supported by the facts. I don't know whether it's worthy of investigation or not, because I haven't seen sufficient evidence on one side or the other to see whether or not there's anything in what they say.
But George, I mean, the reason why I assume that you don't deem it to be worthy of investigation is because you've lambasted the truth movement many times in national newspapers. And I'm assuming that in order to lambast a movement, the truth movement, or any sort of movement, you need to have a knowledge of the rudimentary details of this. Now, the testimony of Jennings, the PNAC document, the Mahmoud Ahmed matter that we've just discussed, have all been featured prominently in Loose Change 2 and Loose Change 3, which are the most...
That is untrue.
Sorry?
Loose Change, even that is untrue. There was no mention of Mahmoud Ahmed in Loose Change 2.
I said Loose Change 2 and Loose Change 3. He's in Loose Change 3.
You said in both of them.
If I can be clear, George.
Emerging of facts, which does your movement no credit at all and is the fundamental problem. Now, let's just address this question that you're putting to me about these two men and what they did or didn't here. You make the assumption that I dismiss anything to do with their testimony because I have been a critic of the 9/11 truth movement. Now, as you are aware, I've written two articles about the 9/11 truth movement, and I have taken grave issue with the claims that it makes. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm going to dismiss out of hand every new line of evidence which emerges. When I wrote those two articles, Loose Change 2 had been produced, but the final cut had not been produced. And if there's more material in the final cut which suggests anything resembling a more interesting case, well, I've looked at it, and there are one or two things, but unfortunately they only relate to issues which are already well known in the public domain and don't suggest a conspiracy actually they made. Now, when I wrote my articles, I attacked the wild supposition in that film, which said the Pentagon couldn't have been hit by a plane; it must have been hit by a missile. Therefore, that was followed, that was fired by the U.S. Air Force. Therefore, Dick Cheney and George Bush were responsible for blowing up the Pentagon. Now, from what I saw of that film and the surrounding evidence, there was no evidence whatsoever to suggest that that was the case. But because I said that, I was lambasted by members of the truth movement. I was called a shill. I was called an agent for the New World Order, all sorts of things. And lo and behold, that claim gets quietly retracted from the final cut of Loose Change without any acknowledgement that they had made the claim in the first place. They just said, oh, yeah, by the way, it was a plane. And similarly with Flight 93, in the second cut of Loose Change, Flight 93 was quietly landed at Cleveland Airport and all the passengers were removed and never seen again. Well, of course, by the time of the final cut, that wild claim had also disappeared. And the problem, it seems to me, is that if you make claims which aren't supported by the evidence, and if you take a small shred of evidence and hang a huge weight of claim off that, then it's very likely to collapse, and you're very likely to end up with egg on your face, as the makers of Loose Change have done.
Right, well, I mean, I'm not Dylan Avery. I'm not here to defend his position either way. I mean, ultimately, the claims that are made, certainly in Loose Change Final Cut, at least one of which I presented to you, are pretty serious, as you've acknowledged. If they turn out to be coherent, then we'll be sending you documents to confirm or deny that. Now, my last question to you is, I guess it's based on sort of a bigger picture issue, and it's one that I've always wondered. If 19 amateurs can fly planes unhindered into some of the most secure buildings within a $1 trillion security infrastructure, why don't we, or why have we never seen such an event or similar events happening in third world countries which have tinpot security systems and, relatively speaking, vast concentrations of terrorists? I mean, for example, today you had the bombing in Sri Lanka, the suicide bombing. He killed 10 people. Now, the aim of a terrorist is to kill as many people as they can. If it's so easy to kill 3,000 people that it can be done within a $1 trillion security infrastructure within the U.S., why don't we see in any country, any third world country which has problems with terrorism, why don't we see this happening all the time? Why have we never seen this happening once?
Well, this is a fascinating line of argument, because what you appear to be saying is that because this hasn't happened elsewhere, it must have been the work of the Bush administration.
That's not what I'm saying at all. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Well, what are you saying? Are you saying that...
The logical conclusion that you deduce from that, that one deduces from such a scenario, is that the reason why you don't see planes flying into buildings in Colombo or in Algeria or in Lebanon is because it's very hard to do. It's not something that's easy to implement. It's something that's very easy to stop, so on and so forth. That's why it doesn't happen. Now, what makes it less easy to happen is when the government of the country, states, or the government, or the people who are controlling the security mechanism, shall we say, that's stopping such events happening, come out in September 2000, a year before the attacks, and come out in advance and state it would be favorable to policy were a new Pearl Harbor to happen. That's what makes it easier to happen, because then the terrorists have the administration more or less on their side. That's the difference.
There are several very major assumptions there and very major leaps that, yet again, you are making.
Right.
And we go back to this problem that you've turned what sounds to me like wishful thinking into actual concrete policy. But also, I believe that there's an assumption behind what you're saying which cannot be sustained, which is that the security in the U.S., before 9/11 was demonstrably better than that in many countries which are in the middle of conflict, such as in Sri Lanka. Have you produced any evidence to support that?
Simply what I said was that it's a $1 trillion security infrastructure, and the degree to which you can assess the quality of a security infrastructure by its expenditure, then you can make that conclusion. I think what would be a massive leap would be to say that the security infrastructure of the US prior to 9/11 was comparable with that of Lebanon. I don't think that's a logical line of reasoning.
Well, you certainly can't assess the quality of a security infrastructure by its expenditure. Otherwise, Mobutu Sese Seko would have conquered most of Africa and indeed Europe.
Why is that?
No, Derek, because he'd spent so many billions on his army.
No, we're talking about security infrastructure. We're not talking about army.
Well, the army is part of that, of course.
Well, no, I'm talking about security infrastructure in the regards of something that will prevent one from a terrorist attack.
What I'm challenging here is your assumption that the amount of money that you spend on that system directly reflects the quality of that system. I'm afraid it doesn't. Very often you get these massive bloated bureaucracies, hugely funded, feather-bedded, which are absolutely incompetent. And indeed, we've seen that again and again with the Bush administration and its security structure. It was focused on the wrong targets. It was completely obsessed with yesterday's wars, yesterday's battles. There were a whole load of placemen put in charge of things which they had no competence to be in charge of at all. We saw, incidentally, exactly the same with New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina, when it turned out that FEMA, which has huge funding, had turned its back on all the measures it should have been concentrating on because it was led by complete incompetent cronies of the Bush administration who didn't know their proverbials from their elbow. And this is, again, a very good example of these great leaps of faith and leaps of supposition that are made. You say, right, you start with the idea that there's $1 trillion security infrastructure. Ergo, leap of supposition number one, it must have been a really good security infrastructure.
That's not what I said.
And it must have been focused on the right threats rather than on the wrong threats.
No.
And it must have been well led, and it must have been an efficient bureaucracy.
No, that's not what I said.
Otherwise, where's all that $1 trillion?
No, that's not what I said at all. I was making a relative judgment between the security infrastructure in the US and the security infrastructure in third world countries. Now, if your position, if you hold your position, that's absolutely fine. If your position is that the security infrastructure of the US pre 9/11 was comparable to that of Lebanon, Sri Lanka, Kashmir, Algeria, countries like that, then that's fine, and I think we can leave the listeners to decide about that. But is that your position? I don't want to mischaracterize it.
This is something you've done all throughout this interview, telling me what my position is. I think I can speak for myself and tell you what my position is, because I think I know my position rather better than you do. And when you've got a state like Sri Lanka, for example, which is entirely focused on a particular terrorist threat and has got a security infrastructure, often a very brutal one, which is whose primary purpose is to suppress that threat, you can expect it to do that pretty efficiently.
Right.
In the United States, you had a huge and bloated security infrastructure which appeared to be looking in all sorts of directions. And not necessarily the right one. Certainly, as far as 9/11 was concerned, not the right one.
Right. Well, except the security infrastructure in Sri Lanka doesn't do its job effectively, because suicide attacks happen very often. Just nothing on the scale of 9/11.
Yes, but as you know, it's much, much easier to carry off a suicide bombing than it is to commandeer an airliner and drive it into a tower. So
which was very easy to happen, and which happened very easily in the US on 9/11.
Oh, it happened very easily because no one was expecting it.
Well, except for the people. Yeah, okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay, George, well, I know you promised me 20 minutes. You've been more than generous. So I'm going to leave you there. I'll send you the documents and the links regarding the Mahmoud Ahmed case and regarding the PNAC document and other things. And I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on them.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks for talking.
Thank you very much.
Bye then.
Bye-bye.
How do you think that went?
I think that I was too polite. Too polite, as in I didn't sort of pursue enough. I wasn't sort of aggressive enough. Which I should have been, really. It's just that, you know, George, I mean, we communicated a few times by email. He's a very cordial and very polite guy, and I was very grateful with him for for granting me this interview. So I think I was a little bit too polite. I should have really pursued him more, because he just did say some absolute nonsense, you know, particularly at the end when he said, I think he makes a comment about how the reason why Sri Lanka hasn't had a 9/11 or Algeria hasn't had a 9/11 is because they spend less on military infrastructure than the US does. And I should have really pursued him on some of the points a lot more, because I think what came out of that interview for me was the fact that although I gave that distribution at the start of the three groups of people who have regarding 9/11 truth, people who know and are for, the people who don't know and are against, and the people who know and are against. And I think that the sort of final group in which Monbiot would pull himself apart, the debunkers, so to speak, I think the main problem with them is that they don't know. They don't know the facts. And this was shown quite drastically with Monbiot. So I would present to him some pretty simple stuff like the PNAC document, which is a pretty fundamental aspect of the truth movement.
Sure.
It's prominently mentioned in Loose Change, the second one, for example. It's in most of the literature on most of the websites. But he had no idea about it. And this is such a fundamental proposition of the argument. And he had no idea about it. That kind of makes me worry. And then when he went on to say that, you're hanging a lot of evidence on that, you're hanging a lot of weight on that to think that just because they wrote this document that they did 9/11. But then again, that kind of illustrates that he doesn't know what the 9/11 truth movement is about. 9/11 truth isn't about saying that, for example, looking at the PNAC document, they wrote this document, therefore they did 9/11. The point is, the base proposition of the truth movement, which I said to Monbiot at the very start, is that there is sufficient evidence of government complicity to warrant a new investigation. And that means that, you know, no matter how many yeah but maybes you can come up with, that doesn't make a difference, because if you can illustrate that there's a big weight of evidence pointing in one direction that warrants an investigation, then that's it, and there's nothing.
You've got to ask the question.
Exactly, so you've got to ask the question, and it's no point just saying, oh yeah, but probably, or oh yeah, but maybe, because that's neither here nor there. Yeah. The fact is that if there's a significant degree of evidence, then you need to pursue it. And he doesn't seem to understand that that's the goal of the truth movement. Whenever he writes about it, he always makes out that the 9/11 truth movement is a movement that wants people to believe that a cruise missile hit the Pentagon, or that explosives blew up the Twin Towers. He doesn't understand it. And I think that's the case for many, many people.
I was a bit disappointed, but not in your questions, but more in him, because when I think he's written some interesting books, notably Captive State, which is a kind of a brilliant section of the beginning of the New Labour, and it was so disappointing. You're someone who sounds off as intelligent and all the rest of it, with anti-war messages and all the rest of it, just make no sense at all. And it also on the line for me that if you're defending the kind of the official line, the establishment line, you don't really have to make sense. You don't really have to have any evidence. If you're kind of countering it, then you really have to have your facts straight.
No, true. But also what was disappointing was that, you know, he's come out and he's decried something on in the national media three times. Let's even if you just take the Loose Change films, you know, but he didn't have. You know, a clue about some of the most fundamental aspects of the film. So, even Loose Change 3, I brought up the Mahmoud Ahmed aspect, the ISI financing of the hijackers, which is again like a very, very fundamental part of the film. It was one of the things that was really developed in Loose Change Final Cut, and he had no idea about it. It wasn't that he came out and said, "Oh, this sounds a little bit, you know, fishy. I don't think it's been well researched or anything like that." He had no idea about it, but yet this is the guy that's come out and slated the film in the national press. And one of the things that's really important about this is that it's very, very difficult to be a debunker of 9/11 truth, because if you're going to be a debunker, you need to debunk every single point. And this is an argument that I think David Ray Griffin has made, and that's that, you know, there are so many points to 9/11 truth. There's so many individual arguments, and for the debunkers to be correct, every single one of those arguments has to be wrong. Every single one, whereas for the truth movement to be correct, only one has to be correct. Absolutely. And so that puts a lot of weight and a lot of responsibility on the debunkers and the task they have to do, because they have to disprove every single major argument, and they have to show that it's not worth investigating, that it's all a complete red herring. But none of them ever do that. They always say, oh yeah, but maybe, or they don't research it well enough, they're not aware of the facts. And I think it's very important that people realise this with Jordan Monbiot, because he's the most prominent one in the UK. And even he falls into this trap pretty drastically.
Well, they've decided that it can't be true, and therefore it isn't true.
That's correct. I really do think that that's... I mean, I have absolutely no doubt that that is the mindset of debunkers. It's that they believe it's... They have a sort of a limit to the discourse they will allow themselves to get involved in. If it sounds too ridiculous, they're just not going to pursue it. You know, no matter what the evidence, they won't listen to it. Even the most, and it will cause them to miss and to misunderstand the most fundamental and basic propositions. Because what the 9/11 Truth Movement is putting forth isn't something that's complicated. Loose Change was a film that was pretty clear, pretty simple. The points were pretty obvious. It's the same arguments that you read on all the websites, and yet Monbiot was unaware of so many of them. The Barry Jennings thing was another one. It's just a startling piece of testimony that was associated with the film, and he had absolutely no idea, and yet he came out and slated the film. It was just made absolutely no sense.
Well, what are you guys moving on? What are you guys? Oh no, sorry. The next thing is. You made a couple of statements that you'd kind of get back to him with different facts. Have you been in touch since, or what's happened?
Yeah, I did. I sent him a few details, because he did say about the Mahmoud Ahmed aspect that he said, oh yeah, this does actually sound pretty fishy, you know, and it would need to be pursued, and if it has merit, and so on and so forth. So I sent him the details, and I sent him basically references and links to newspaper articles, reputable newspaper articles from India to Kashmir from the UK to the US, citing Indian intelligence, German intelligence, US intelligence. And he replied to me and said, well, yeah, you know, this would be interesting if it were actually, if it were confirmed, but to me this all seemed like gossip. You know, it just doesn't seem credible. Gossip was the word he used, I think. And again, this is just like another sort of, I guess, tactic, if you like. It's just continually raising the bar of reasonable doubt.
Suddenly the Wall Street Journal is not worth quoting.
Yeah, exactly. And the point, it comes back to the point that I made earlier, which is that it's a complete, it illustrates a complete misunderstanding of what this is all about, because, you know, it may just be gossip. It may just be gossip, it may just be a wild goose chase, it may be that all these newspapers have misquoted all these intelligence agencies, and it's all false. Maybe. It may well be the case. But the point is that when you have such a weight of evidence, and this is just one illustration, when you have such a weight of evidence, you can't deny that there's a need for an investigation into this. And maybe the naysayers will be proved right. Maybe they will. But the point is that there is so much evidence that you can't say it can't be investigated. And this is the point of the Truth Movement, and it's something that the debunkers just absolutely constantly, without fail, cannot understand, in my opinion.
Okay, well, you know, thank you very much, and good luck to you and your new colleagues in Paris, and we look forward to seeing you in London sometime soon.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
No problem.
Take it easy.
Hello?
Hello, can I help you?
Yes, I am phoning because I'm concerned that your hotline is not doing what they should be doing.
Why is that then?
Because I've phoned up on a number of occasions, and I've spoken to people, and I've detailed evidence that requires investigation, and on the most recent times I've phoned, the phone's been put down on me, and I suspect by yourself, because your voice sounds a little bit familiar to me.
So what information have you got, sir?
Well, I could direct you in the right place. I could direct you to a website called the Journal of 9/11studies.com, which mm-hmm. is a resource for peer-reviewed scientific research into the events of September the 11th, which suggests that it was a false flag operation.
It was a what, sorry?
A false flag operation, where a government, an organisation, or a company carry out an attack on their own people and blame it on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the evidence with an open mind,
mm-hmm.
The 7/7 attacks and 9/11 attacks and the Madrid bombings and the Bali bombings all fit that model.
I'd have to disagree.
You'd disagree?
Yeah, I'd have to disagree, yeah.
Okay, because... There's so much evidence out there, the main evidence being what happened to those buildings.
What happened to people on the Pentagon plane? What happened to them?
I have absolutely no idea what happened to them.
All right. Is that not part of your theory, though?
Well, it's not so much a theory. It's I have no idea what happened at the Pentagon. I have no idea what happened in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Because it would appear that the entire thing was designed so that people would argue amongst themselves until the end of time. But the evidence regarding what happened to those buildings is quite conclusive. And that's why there's, for example, there's an organization called Architects and Engineers from 9/11 Truth. And they've got 400 architects and engineering professionals all calling for an investigation into what happened to those buildings.
Because
the people that are actually charged with investigating it, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, only investigated the buildings until they're poised to collapse. So they didn't actually account for what happened to the buildings to come down.
What about 7/7 then?
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with Mr. Peter Power, aren't you?
So what did happen on the 7th of July 2005 then? What's the theory there?
Well,
I
don't have a theory. I just know that the official version is most likely not true because of the sole reason Peter Power carrying out a training exercise on the exact same train stations at the exact same time that went from drill to life.
How do you account for the people who we know actually committed the...
You don't know, do you? We don't know.
Yes, we do.
How do we know?
Forensic evidence will prove that.
Okay, are you aware that John Loftus, a district attorney in the United States, who was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, he went on Fox News and said that the supposed mastermind of the bombings, Haroon Rashid Aswat, was a MI6 informant?
Yeah, I'm a bit dubious about that. I always keep an open mind about everything.
The point is,
and there are certain things about 9/11 which are quite interesting, but in relation to 7/7, I've got absolutely no doubt whatsoever that the four people who were named were involved and did it. Nothing to do with MI6 whatsoever.
But it's been demonstrated that Haroon Rashid Aswat was an MI6 informant, and he was the supposed mastermind.
I don't think so.
And Peter Power was carrying out an exercise that envisages the exact same circumstances that occurred, which is just too ridiculous for words.
Yeah, I remember him being interviewed on television at the time.
You remember seeing him on television?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've been interviewed, yeah.
So it was quite an admission, because it's just completely improbable that it would be by coincidence.
I don't think he named the exact tube stations, did he? I think he said at certain tube stations.
No, he said the exact same tube stations.
Well, it's very interesting talking to you, but...
My point is, because I've phoned up a number of times, and I don't think I'm getting anywhere, because I've studied this for about 2 years. I've looked into it. I've met people that are from the 7/7 campaign and the 9/11 truth campaign, who've had looked into it as much as me and come to the same conclusions. And I'm sure you guys are you think you're doing a good job, but... Really, it's just a complete waste of time. It's counterproductive.
Really?
Yeah, because 9/11 wasn't done by Muslims. It was most likely state-sponsored.
Okay, well, I can't speak for America, really, but in relation to 7/7, we know exactly what happened,
We don't know. There's been no proper investigation. There's been a narrative.
No, that's ridiculous. No proper investigation.
No, we were given a narrative.
Do you know how much work went into the investigation into 7/7? It's ridiculous. I mean, I think, to be honest, you're being somewhat naive.
I'm not being somewhat naive. Are you aware of Operation Gladio? This is a historical fact that states carry out attacks on their own people in order to scale back civil liberties. It's documented. Are you familiar with Operation Gladio?
I think it's a little bit extreme for 7/7, don't you?
No,
in this day and age.
It's what NATO did in the 70s. It's what they did with the IRA. It's what they wanted to do with Operation Northwoods in Cuba. It's the same historical model that they use over and over and over again because it works.
Okay, interesting theory.
Well, it's not a theory. I suppose it is a theory, yeah. But your theory that Muslims did it is not only racist, it doesn't support the...
It's not racist. It's actually factual, I think you'll find. Anyway, what? I've got other stuff to do, so I need to go.
All right.
Cheers.
Bye. Well, it's time to wrap this up now. We know it's been a long show, and we'll try and keep it short in the future. Just had a lot to share with you, and we hope you find that even if everything wasn't your cup of tea, you found something which spoke to your heart today. We're going to play you out with We the People by Peyote for President. If you're listening to this on September 11th during the day, then please get down to the Cross Kings pub in King's Cross tonight for an evening called We the People, put on by We Are Change UK, and featuring Peyote for President alongside Yap from Pink Punk, Rob the Rub, Sarah Bear, and other political truth music acts. This night is We Are Change's UK fundraiser for the Feel Good Foundation, which is featured in the documentary The Elephant in the Room. And we want to make sure we can send a decent donation over to John Feel to show support for this cause. So if you can come out, please do. Come and support us so we can support them. If you can't make it, maybe you're listening after the gig and you haven't yet mastered time travel, find out what the Feel Good Foundation is all about and make a donation. And you can do this by visiting their website, which is The Feel Good Foundation, that's spelled F-E-A-L, goodfoundation.com. That's F-E-A-L-G-O-O-D, foundation.com. And, you know, find out what they're all about and support that campaign. So, here's Peyote for President, We Are the People. The single is released on 11th of September 2008 and can be downloaded from iTunes and all of those other digital download type places. We'll be back with more audio activism on the 11th of next month. Until then, keep your eyes open, keep thinking, keep reading, and whatever you read, remember to read between the lines. Take care.
That you need another army platoon. Say, we the people, don't buy all the shit that exudes from your lip, but that's your bet you dip. We buy the papers that give us information. See the faces you're facing, go boom. Celebrity lads, down with the television, bye-bye, down with the magazines, bye-bye, down with the things we no longer want to buy, down with the politician man, goodbye. Commodity, pathology, and criminality, allergy, competing in the partnership of looking at the allergy. God made the world, but the world man makes God. They sell them on the internet, or reinvent the alphabet. They take our words and they twist all the meaning. Kill your first onion, pay your first stealing. System of globalization. We see through it, cause your number is up, your number is up. You better believe it that your number is up. We're going to get you cause your number is up. And we don't give a damn and we don't give a fuck. Your number is up, your number is up. You better believe it that your number is up. We're going to get you cause your number is up. Give a damn and we don't give a fuck. You see, this shit just isn't working at the moment, you know? Dog eat dog and
I'm so beautiful, I'm worth it.
To the sound of a clown like the man on the moon. We the people get mad when you tell us that you need another army platoon. See, we the people don't buy all the shit that it do. Shove your lip with the tip that you chip. We buy the papers that give us information. See the faces you're facing, go boom. I,
and we don't give a fuck. Cause your number is up, your number is up. You better believe it, your number is up. We're going to get you cause your number is up. We don't give a damn and we don't give a fuck. Cause your number is up, your number is up. You better believe it, your number is up.